Chapter 8. Weather, time of day or night, food, rest. Under such a hurry of the spirits, and such incessant occupation, the strongest constitution will commonly go down. Hers, neither of the strongest nor the weakest, yielded to the burden, and began to sink. To have saved her life, then, by taking action on the warning that shone in her eyes and sounded in her voice, would have been impossible without changing her nature. As long as the power of moving about in the old way was left to her, she must exercise it, or be killed by the restraint. And so the time came when she could move about no longer, and took to her bed. All the restlessness gone then, and all the sweet patience of her natural disposition purified by the resignation of her soul, she lay upon her bed through the whole round of changes of the seasons. She lay upon her bed through 15 months. In all that time, her old cheerfulness never quitted her. In all that time, not an impatient or a querulous minute can be remembered. At length, at midnight on the 2nd of February, 1864, she turned down a leaf of a little book she was reading, and shut it up. The ministering hand that had copied the verses into the tiny album was soon around her neck, and she quietly asked, as the clock was on the stroke of 1, "Do you think I am dying, Mama?" "I think you are very, very ill tonight, my dear. Send for my sister. My feet are so cold. Lift me up." Her sister entering as they raised her, she said, "It has come at last," and with a bright and happy smile, looked upward, and departed. Well had she written, "Why shouldst thou fear the beautiful angel, Death, who waits thee at the portals of the skies, ready to kiss away thy struggling breath, ready with gentle hand to close thine eyes? Oh, what were life, if life were all? Thine eyes are blinded by their tears, or thou wouldst see thy treasures wait thee in the far-off skies, and Death, thy friend, will give them all to thee." Chauncey Hare Townshend Explanatory Introduction to Religious Opinions by the late Reverend Chauncey Hare Townshend. Mr. Chauncey Hare Townshend died in London on the 25th of February 1868. His will contained the following passage: "I appoint my friend Charles Dickens, of Gad's Hill Plus, in the county of Kent, Esquire, my literary executor, and beg of him to publish without alteration as much of my notes and reflections as may make known my opinions on religious matters, they being such as I verily believe would be conducive to the happiness of mankind. In pursuance of the foregoing injunction, the literary executor so appointed, not previously aware that the publication of any religious opinions would be enjoined upon him, applied himself to the examination of the numerous papers left by his deceased friend. Some of these were in Lawson, and some were in London. Considerable delay occurred before they could be got together, arising out of certain claims preferred, and formalities insisted on by the authorities of the Canton de Vaud. When at length the whole of his late friend's papers passed into the literary executor's hands, it was found that religious opinions were scattered up and down through a variety of memoranda and notebooks, the gradual accumulation of years and years. Many of the following pages were carefully transcribed, numbered, connected, and prepared for the press, but many more were dispersed fragments, originally written in pencil, afterwards inked over, the intended sequence of which in the writer's mind, it was extremely difficult to follow. These again were intermixed with journals of travel, fragments of poems, critical essays, voluminous correspondence, and old school exercises and college themes, having no kind of connection with them. To publish such materials without alteration was simply impossible. But finding everywhere internal evidence that Mr. Townshend's religious opinions had been constantly meditated and reconsidered with great pains and sincerity throughout his life, the literary executor carefully compiled them always in the writer's exact words, and endeavored in piecing them together to avoid needless repetition. He does not doubt that Mr. Townshend held the clue to a precise plan, which could have greatly simplified the presentation of these views, and he has devoted the first section of this volume to Mr. Townshend's own notes of his comprehensive intentions, proofs of the devout spirit in which they were conceived, and of the sense of responsibility with which he worked at them, abound through the whole mass of papers. Mr. Townshend's varied attainments, delicate tastes, and amiable and gentle nature, caused him to be beloved through life by the variously distinguished men who were his compeers at Cambridge long ago. To his literary executor he was always a warmly attached and sympathetic friend. To the public, he has been a most generous benefactor, both in his munificent bequest of his collection of precious stones in the South Kensington Museum, and in the devotion of the bulk of his property to the education of poor children. On Mr. Fechter's acting, the distinguished artist whose name is prefixed to these remarks purposes to leave England for a professional tour in the United States. A few words from me, in reference to his merits as an actor, I hope may not be uninteresting to some readers, in advance of his publicly proving them before an American audience, and I know, will not be unacceptable to my intimate friend. I state at once that Mr. Fechter holds that relation towards me, not only because it is a fact, but also because our friendship originated in my public appreciation of him. I had studied his acting closely, and had admired it highly, both in Paris and in London, years before we exchanged a word. Consequently, my appreciation is not the result of personal regard, but personal regard has sprung out of my appreciation. The first quality observable in Mr. Fechter's acting is that it is in the highest degree romantic. However elaborated in minute details, there is always a peculiar dash and vigor in it, like the fresh atmosphere of the story, whereof it is a part. When he is on the stage, it seems to me as though the story were transpiring before me for the first and last time. Thus there is a fervor in his love-making, a suffusion of his whole being with the rapture of his passion, that sheds a glory on its object, and raises her, before the eyes of the audience, into the light in which he sees her. It was this remarkable power that took Paris by storm, when he became famous in the lover's part in the Dame aux Camélias. It is a short part, really comprised in two scenes, but, as he acted it, he was its original representative. It left its poetic and exulting influence on the heroine throughout the play. A woman who could be so loved, who could be so devotedly and romantically adored, had a hold upon the general sympathy with which nothing less absorbing and complete could have invested her. When I first saw this play and this actor, I could not, in forming my lenient judgment of the heroine, forget that she had been the inspiration of a passion, of which I had beheld such profound and affecting marks. I said to myself, as a child might have said, a bad woman could not have been the object of that wonderful tenderness, could not have so subdued that worshipping heart, could not have drawn such tears from such a lover. I am persuaded that the same effect was wrought upon the Parisian audiences, both consciously and unconsciously, to a very great extent, and that what was morally disagreeable in the Dame aux Camélias first got lost in this brilliant halo of romance. I have seen the same play with the same part otherwise acted, and in exact degree as the love became dull and earthy, the heroine descended from her pedestal. In Rye Blas, in The Master of Ravenswood, and in The Lady of Lyons, three dramas in which Mr. Fechter especially shines as a lover, but notably in the first, this remarkable power of surrounding the beloved creature, in the eyes of the audience, with the fascination that she has for him, is strikingly displayed. That observer must be cold indeed who does not feel, when Rye Blas stands in the presence of the young unwedded Queen of Spain, that the air is enchanted, or, when she bends over him, laying her tender touch upon his bloody breast, that it is better so, to die than to live apart from her, and that she is worthy to be so died for. When the Master of Ravenswood declares his love to Lucy Ashton, and she hears to him, and when in a burst of rapture, he kisses the skirt of her dress, we feel as though we touched it with our lips, to stay our goddess from soaring away into the very heavens. And when they plight their troth, and break the piece of gold, it is we not Edgar who quickly exchange our half for the half she was about to hang about her neck, solely because the latter has for an instant touched the bosom we so dearly love. Again, in The Lady of Lyons, the picture on the easel in the poor cottage studio is not the unfinished portrait of a vain and arrogant girl, but becomes the sketch of a soul's high ambition and aspiration here and hereafter. Picturesqueness is a quality above all others pervading Mr. Fechter's assumptions. Himself a skilled painter and sculptor, learned in the history of costume, and informing those accomplishments and that knowledge with a similar infusion of romance, for romance is inseparable from the man, he is always a picture, always a picture in its right place in the group, always in true composition with the background of the scene. For picturesqueness of manner, note so trivial a thing as the turn of his hand in beckoning from a window, in Rye Blas, to a personage down in an outer courtyard to come up, or his assumption of the Duke's livery in the same scene, or his writing a letter from dictation. In the last scene of Victor Hugo's noble drama, his bearing becomes positively inspired. And his sudden assumption of the attitude of the headsman, in his denunciation of the Duke and threat to be his executioner, is, so far as I know, one of the most ferociously picturesque things conceivable on the stage. The foregoing use of the word ferociously reminds me to remark that this artist is a master of passionate vehemence, in which aspect he appears to me to represent, perhaps more than in any other, an interesting union of characteristics of two great nations, the French and the Anglo-Saxon. Born in London of a French mother, by a German father, but reared entirely in England and in France, there is, in his fury, a combination of French suddenness and impressibility with our more slowly demonstrative Anglo-Saxon way when we get, as we say, our blood up, that produces an intensely fiery result. The fusion of two races is in it, and one cannot decidedly say that it belongs to either, but one can most decidedly say that it belongs to a powerful concentration of human passion and emotion, and to human nature. Mr. Fechter has been in the main more accustomed to speak French than to speak English, and therefore he speaks our language with a French accent. But whosoever should suppose that he does not speak English fluently, plainly, distinctly, and with a perfect understanding of the meaning, weight, and value of every word, would be greatly mistaken. Not only is his knowledge of English extending to the most subtle idiom, or the most recondite cant phrase more extensive than that of many of us who have English for our mother tongue, but his delivery of Shakespeare's blank verse is remarkably facile, musical, and intelligent. To be in a sort of pain for him, as one sometimes is for a foreigner speaking English, or to be in any doubt of his having 20 synonyms at his tongue's end, if he should want one, is out of the question after having been of his audience. A few words on two of his Shakespearean impersonations, and I shall have indicated enough, in advance of Mr. Fechter's presentation of himself. That quality of picturesqueness, on which I have already laid stress, is strikingly developed in his Iago, and yet it is so judiciously governed, that his Iago is not in the least picturesque according to the conventional ways of frowning, sneering, diabolically grinning, and elaborately doing everything else, that would induce Othello to run him through the body very early in the play. Mr. Fechter's is the Iago who could, and did, make friends, who could dissect his master's soul, without flourishing his scalpel, as if it were a walking stick, who could overpower Amelia by other arts than a sign of the Saracen's head grimness, who could be a boon companion without ipso facto warning all beholders off by the portentous phenomenon, who could sing a song and clink a can naturally enough, and stab men really in the dark, not in a transparent notification of himself as going about seeking whom to stab. Mr. Fechter's Iago is no more in the conventional psychological mode than in the conventional Husser pantaloons and boots, and you shall see the picturesqueness of his wearing borne out in his bearing all through the tragedy down to the moment when he becomes invincibly and consistently dumb. Perhaps no innovation in art was ever accepted with so much favor by so many intellectual persons pre-committed to and preoccupied by another system as Mr. Fechter's Hamlet. I take this to have been the case, as it unquestionably was in London, not because of its picturesqueness, not because of its novelty, not because of its many scattered beauties, but because of its perfect consistency with itself. As the animal painter said of his favorite picture of rabbits, that there was more nature about those rabbits than you usually found in rabbits, so it may be said of Mr. Fechter's Hamlet, that there was more consistency about that Hamlet than you usually found in Hamlets. Its great and satisfying originality was in its possessing the merit of a distinctly conceived and executed idea. From the first appearance of the broken glass of fashion and mold of form, pale and worn with weeping for his father's death, and remotely suspicious of its cause, to his final struggle with Horatio for the fatal cup, there were cohesion and coherence in Mr. Fechter's view of the character. Devrient, the German actor, had, some years before in London, fluttered the theatrical doves considerably, by such changes as being seated when instructing the players, and like mild departures from established usage. But he had worn, in the main, the old nondescript dress, and had held forth, in the main, in the old way, hovering between sanity and madness. I do not remember whether he wore his hair crisply curled short, as if he were going to an everlasting dancing master's party at the Danish court, but I do remember that most other Hamlets since the great Campbell had been bound to do so. Mr. Fechter's Hamlet, a pale, weebigan Norseman with long flaxen hair, wearing a strange garb never associated with the part upon the English stage, if ever seen there at all, and making a piratical swoop upon the whole fleet of little theatrical prescriptions without meaning, or, like Dr. Johnson's celebrated friend, with only one idea in them, and the wrong one, never could have achieved its extraordinary success, but for its animation by one pervading purpose, to which all changes were made intelligently subservient. The bearing of this purpose on the treatment of Ophelia, on the death of Polonius, and on the old student fellowship between Hamlet and Horatio, was exceedingly striking. And the difference between picturesqueness of stage arrangement for mere stage effect, and for the elucidation of a meaning, was well displayed in there having been a gallery of musicians at the play, and in one of them passing on his way out, with his instrument in his hand, when Hamlet, seeing it, took it from him, to point his talk with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. This leads me to the observation with which I have all along desired to conclude, that Mr. Fechter's romance and picturesqueness are always united to a true artist's intelligence, and a true artist's training in a true artist's spirit. He became one of the company of the Theatre Francaise when he was a very young man, and he has cultivated his natural gifts in the best schools. I cannot wish my Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.